Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
It's Mara and Sarah, and they run Honey and Co. Honey and Co, they've been going for a few years now. They've got a couple. I think they've got 3 different restaurants. They've got like a bakery, then they've got 2 other restaurants, and the food is just so wonderful. They've got this absolute fulsome, homely energy when they cook.
I read a review of their book, Fire and Smoke. And I thought, oh yeah. And I just loved the way Itamar spoke about food. And then I tasted their food at the restaurant a few months later, and I was like, oh, this is all so inextricably linked. Like, who they are is hugely in their food.
They are Israeli, so their food is like Levantine. So it's really interesting mixture of that whole strip of the world, you know, kind of bulgur and beautifully slow-cooked meats and beautiful dressings and a lot of barbecuing, actually. Yeah.
And we're very excited that their guest is Polly Russell, who's an incredible food historian. And what a job! What a job! But definitely just has an encyclopedic knowledge of the history and the journey of ingredients. I think it's a really good way to talk about history.
It's a really good way to talk about history. It's a really good way in, because what people eat, when they ate it, why they ate it, how they ate it, absolutely tells you a massive, massive story. And Polly's from the British Library. She's one of the head curators at the British Library. So she's a really interesting woman. She runs the British Library food season. So it's really lovely that they've brought her.
Do you feel like you cook differently when you're cooking for chefs?
I think I might make more things. Because I just want, I mean, for me, it's not really about trying to impress people. Because if you try to impress people, inevitably you it's shit. So the thing to do is just to try to do things that you know are really delicious. And then inevitably that will make people happy. It's not about impressing people, it's about making them happy.
Yeah.
Which is I'm much more interested in.
Oh yeah, she's a big people pleaser through her food.
There might be 2 more dishes extra on the table because I want them to feel like, yeah.
Hello there.
Hello.
Hi.
Are you kidding? You know you're gonna need to get security to get us out of here.
Double Tupperware.
We're moving in.
Tupperware.
What are you talking about, Tupperware?
Tupperware.
Is this the level of service? You're never gonna get rid of us.
Say who we're talking to?
Yes. We're talking to Itamar and Sarit, who are my lovely friends from Honey & Co. And they brought with them... Who have you brought with you?
We brought our beautiful latest addition to the Friendship Circle, which is Polly Russell. The latest and the best, I have to say.
Yeah, your favourite.
Yeah.
Am I the last friend you
Well, how...
Like, meaningfully, yes.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. This is one that's become a part of our lives, yes.
Yeah, aww. For sure.
You're at the British Library, Polly. So your job, what is your actual title?
Yes. She's a naughty librarian. She's a naughty librarian.
Wow.
I'm the head of the Eccles Centre for American Studies at the British Library.
Which is a much more impressive title.
And I'm a naughty librarian.
Is it though?
And I run a food season at the British Library with a team of people.
Which I've been in!
Yay! And they've been in.
And we've been in. And it's very interesting and fascinating.
It's, and it's you've brilliant. Been to see our collection, some new Caribbean collections.
My goodness. Yeah, that was we should actually, let's serve ourselves while we're quite heavy. About this stuff. So we've got some rum and ginger braised ribs. We've got some two different types of poached beetroot with pickled berries, with like blackberries and blueberries. There's a mustardy one and then a sort of smoky one. And then we've got some barbecued aubergines with green seasoning, pickled shallots and crispy shallots. We've got a turmeric mayonnaise and a white potato plantain pakora and some Johnny cakes. Yeah.
Yay, wow.
I'm excited.
When did you first get here?
Well, I came first time 2000 was the first time I came here. But I came alone first time around.
And you do obviously work quite intensely together. That's such a... I mean, we talk about the fact that my mum doesn't really love, like, the closest people to her are the people that I think she finds most annoying in her kitchen. Does that make sense?
Do you mean you?
Yeah. Me and my dad.
Sadly referencing.
Me and my father. But as a couple, they're not harmonious in a kitchen together.
We're not harmonious in anything.
We do. But the nice tension of it, it's true. The nice tension of it is what creates what we do as well.
Right.
So we try never to work in a kitchen together anymore. Mm-hmm. Not in the same one.
Not unless we absolutely have to.
What comes up between you when you're in a kitchen cooking together?
First of all, we want to boss each other around because that's like, because our definition, because we are the boss, then we boss everyone that we work with because that's just what we do. And then we do it to each other, but we don't need to because we each know what we're doing and no one needs to tell the other one what to do. But we're just so used to that's just the way we speak.
But also, we're so...
In a boss way.
We're so like different from each other. Like, I'll tell you yesterday...
Oh, the mate you laughed about.
My God, that was so funny. It was the most sorry thing I've ever seen done. She was trimming okra. And when she was laying the okra on a tray, like in little piles, and she was grading them according to size.
Oh, nice. Very soothing.
50 by 30 tray of okra... laid like soldiers and piled and but the difference in size between this one and this one was like a centimeter.
No.
But we had 5 grades.
That's so meticulous. I love
it's not
that.
True. There were some really long ones and some short ones. It would go differently.
Itama would never do that. So this is where the what would you do? Would you just be topping and telling them chuck them on a pile?
Yeah. Yeah. That is, like, wouldn't...
I was going to say, you probably wouldn't even top and tail them. You're just like, okay.
Yeah.
I'm into that. I'm into, like, really...
Because that's how Makita organises her clothes.
Yeah. Well, I think what I've liked getting older, actually, is that I think the way your mind works is directly kind of linked to the things that you've loved forever. And I've always liked kind of, because this lady has not always been that organized. I've always had a very organized. She is now. But not, she's 20 when she had me. It was chaos. Sorry.
Sorry. It's true, but how
dare you? If you didn't have such a funky, reckless, rebellious spirit, you wouldn't be such a brilliant chef.
Well, you know what I'm saying?
There you go. And if I wasn't so anal, my wardrobe wouldn't be so beautiful.
God, I don't know. It sometimes makes me a bit panicky how but what are organized
the things that, what are the things that you are organized in? Because everyone has
the
like
kitchen.
The things that yeah.
Yeah. So in the kitchen, I'm really organized in the kitchen because I can't bear not being.
Yeah.
I can't, you know, work in a kind of complete...
No,
you know,
so
chaos.
This is the thing, is people have it in different places in their life.
Yes.
Because you need it somewhere, because you can't have everything being absolute chaos.
One of the things that makes me happiest is, like, in a restaurant with mise en place, when everything is just ready, just before service.
So beautiful.
And everything is put, all the garnishes
on
little
pretty.
Trays.
The calmness
and everything's ready, and it's ready to go, and it's about to kick in.
Yeah.
I only learned, and my mother's a chef, what mise en place is last year when I was doing Bake Off. My mum went, you've got to get your mise en place sorted. And I was like, what is that? And I was like, oh, that's that thing you guys all shout at each other and say you're going to do. But what is it? And I actually thought it was a really interesting thing. One chef, if you'd like to explain what it is.
Mise en place, it's everything in place before service, ready to go.
Yes.
So all your prep, all your garnishes, all your everything you're going to need, almost in the order you're going to need it.
Yes.
On the pass, so that when the plates come up, you're ready to finish the plates and get it onto the pass and send it out.
Yes, like setting up the production line.
Yes. It's the production line.
It's the production line.
So when you got here, though, 20 odd years, right?
Yeah.
What were you greeted with in terms of the industry? What were restaurants? What was happening then, really?
It it was very chainy, like a lot of big chains. So I, when I came back, first it was working for Conran Group. That was the big kind of thing. Everyone was working for the Conran Group. All the restaurants were like the Conran, very fine kind of dining, this like modern European. And then Jay Shiki's, which is also kind of like a restaurant group and very kind of European leaning. Like what we struggled with mostly was finding the food we would eat. And it was very fine dining-y, but fine dining that was not even, not what we're talking today about Michelin, like kind of fake fine dining.
I mean, as I remember that kind of time, it was a bit like that kind of dead hotel energy. Do you know what I mean? That weird chicken where I don't understand what they've done to it. How do they make it have that weird texture?
You wouldn't have independent restaurant. You needed a chunk of money if you wanted to open a restaurant.
Right. No, not just that. We were jobbing chefs at the time. We couldn't afford to go out that much. Jobbing chefs back 20 years ago, what, we earned like £1,000 a month or something like that, and we worked most of the time. So like, we didn't really go out.
That middle area, that's that kind of, well, they call it casual dining, which I always find a little bit odd because it's not fancy, but it's still going out for dinner, do you know what I mean? And that didn't exist in the way that it exists now at all.
No.
You know.
You would do like the takeaway places or the like Indian, the Chinese kind of thing.
So how did you kick your stuff off then? What did you do?
It doesn't sound like the easiest climate to start something in.
Well, we did, when we opened Honey & Co, we came back from Australia and they had the most amazing scene. And you would go to these like really young, vibrant places. And
independent.
Independent. And we thought maybe, you know, people want that sort of non-corporate thing. And it was kind of like the tail end of the financial crisis in 2010, 11, 12. And you could still kind of like wrangle through. And our place was tiny. Do you remember the first Honey & Co. was kind of like the size of this table?
Oh, in Warren Street, yeah.
We didn't even have like a proper business plan or anything. We could afford the rent. And it had a working kitchen. And that was it. And we just said, we're just going to go in and we just start cooking. And we honestly didn't have like... Because what we were looking for, which was like to do like a proper like fire kebab place with lots of things, we couldn't afford. Nobody was talking to us. We were just two chefs out of like kind of working for other people. So we didn't have any kind of name. And it was quite hard to like get any of the proper properties we were looking at. We couldn't afford them either. And then we just said, we're just going to cook. And that's literally what happened. The first meal was one of our kind of most standard meals ever, like sinia, and which is like a lamb with a tahini crust thing, which we would have for dinner loads of times, and a salad. We would put like three dishes on the menu and two salads. And then the next day we'd cook a different three dishes and a different two salads. And then slowly it kind of, but people...
And then we couldn't work at till, so all the starters were £4 and all the mains were £8.
It's true, we didn't remember. We didn't know how to do it.
So we just said, okay, we'll just do everything at £4 and all the mains at £8.
Yeah, it's good margins.
So funny.
Mm-hmm. And what were people like? Did people respond quickly to it, like, well, quickly, or did it take quite a long time?
No, it was so fast.
Wow.
And we didn't expect it at all. Because we were so, like, naive and didn't know anything, we didn't even do any, like, definitely we didn't do any market research on where the location was. Right. We knew nothing. We went to Warren Street Tube. We said, oh, there's a lot of people coming out of this station in rush hour. They must need to eat something. That was our market research.
Polly, you've got to pick up your hands. Go for it. You've got to use your hands.
Got to pick up.
Come on, Polly.
Come on.
I know you're in a white silk
blouse. Yeah, she's trying to, like,
to
protect them.
That is what's scaring me.
That is terrifying.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
I was just wanting to actually talk about this incredible opportunity that Polly gave my mother and I to go to the British Library and see the collection of things from Antigua. And just throughout the years, it just so... Honestly, I really didn't get to thank you for that. It was really beautiful. And
you definitely thanked us.
Okay. Just to explain. So Polly and her team invited Makita and I to the British Library to be part of the Caribbean collection, but it was from Antigua, which is where our family are from. And on it, we could see where the Oliver Plantation was, which is actually at the end of the street that the princes, our family, grew up on. And it's where my dad, who is the Oliver name, that's where he grew up in Point.
So he would have been growing up like on his old plantation maybe even knowing.
So much of that stuff lives in your head. You know, you're diaspora, you come from diasporic peoples, you know, we've all been through all kinds of shit, do you know what I mean, historically. And it's so much of it is kind of theory, you know, so when you see the actual
evidence,
the evidence kind of material, this is where it happened, reality. It really makes your blood stop moving around your body or something.
For me, it was an opening up, because we've been back to the Caribbean quite a few times, we've been very lucky, we've been going quite often, I have to say.
Yeah.
And I've been doing a lot more, looking into just like how agriculturally the Caribbean was changed by enslavement and colonization. I didn't really think about things like that. I just thought about just the pain of people, but actually how land was changed. And I just thought, oh, Polly must know so much about that.
Well, I know a tiny bit, but definitely like Nicole Rochelle Moore, who you met.
Oh, God, yeah, she was amazing.
She's the Caribbean curator. She's just incredible woman. Well, you saw her talking the other day at the British Library.
But just talking about the history through food. And,
yeah, through food and just how those collections map those unbelievable and devastating changes, you know, whether it's in maps, whether it's on manuscripts, whether it's on newspapers, that we've got these collections that tell these stories and make real the histories that, you know, generations live with. The
I want to say to you, it means so much that you're opening up in the ways that you are and the conversations that are happening at the British Library and the things that I've been part of really mean a lot to me, Polly, and I'm really grateful to you for it. Honestly, it's special and it's really important and it makes you feel seen. And it makes you feel heard, and it makes you feel like people give a shit. And that those three things are...
But the library is doing so much in trying to address things that have gone wrong.
Well, Polly is.
Yeah.
And Michael, actually, you're making me kind of go goosey, because this is sort of why we all get up in the morning, is that there are these amazing collections that tell these stories, but that belong to all of us. They belong to you. You know, they are your stories. They're our stories. And that is what we get up to do. It's so exciting to be able to make those connections and get new people in, different people in, to understand them and to feel like they belong to those collections. Those collections belong to them. So that is like, and it is, I mean, I'm one cog in a massive wheel, and there are amazing people there with that energy, and you've met lots of them who want to do that. So for you to say that, like, I think I might have to just like put that on a recording and play it very loud. The whole you'll see people curating the British Library cheering from St Pancras. Yes,
we did it. But can I say that Polly is very characteristically being very humble, but she is such a driving force for good that honestly in her life and in her work that is just amazing. You know, she's like the good Karen.
The good Karen.
She's like, what is Millie?
Okay, so good Millie, Karen. My 18-year-old daughter, who obviously very begrudgingly would ever say anything nice to me because she's 18. Yeah. She's like, oh, Mum, the thing about you is you're always like sort of Karening the fuck out of shit for good. She's so good. You kind of are sharp-elbowed, but you are sort of good, but still annoying.
That's absolutely amazing.
Carrying the best line.
Shit for good. It's like, that's, like, you know what?
That, okay, I guess that's okay. Polly,
honestly, I think that's her saying I love you. Like, it's like I love you when I see you. Do you guys know how to relax and rest? I don't know many chefs that are that one.
Yeah, do you stop? Sarah, do you stop?
We do. Like, I mean, we love a good holiday.
Yeah.
And we
How often do you have them?
It depends, and it depends what's happening. If you talk to us, like, this month, where there's after a streak of, like, kind of, we feel, like, a bit guilty because we've just kind of...
Been away
quite a bit. We went to Amsterdam to see the Vermeer exhibition, and then we went to Italy to one of our friends who used to be our pastry chef's wedding, which was amazing.
Mm-hmm. How does a chef know when to step out of the kitchen?
When their number two says to them...
When you can.
Like Julia says to us, she's our head exec chef. She says to us, you're sabotaging your own business. Yeah. Please step away from the kitchen now.
Really?
So when your number two says that to you, you know, okay.
Is she quite strict with you?
Yeah.
With everyone.
Is she?
Yeah. Julia is amazing. But she knows to say to us... Because, you know, the problem is, Itamar and I, when we started cooking, we would come into the kitchen and we would just cook. You know, throw this in a pot, throw that in a pot, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. So then we started writing recipes and they actually followed them, which meant the food that was going out every day was the same food. So now we come into the kitchen and we're just like, oh, let's put a bit of that. Oh, we can change it. And she's like, stop.
Please don't
do that. Don't just add something else to the food.
Yeah.
We have a recipe for a reason.
Yeah.
Because it's costed and it works and it's delicious. We're in a step away like from it. My kitchen.
Yeah, my kitchen. Yeah. But so was this is interesting to me. For me, the most difficult part of any of it, all of it, writing, anything, restaurants, has been the like quantifying.
With the tiny
cinnamon. Yes, 5 grams of cinnamon.
Yes, so this is something we had to learn because we had to teach these guys how to cook. And because we couldn't continue, because at the beginning we used to work like 16 hours every day, all the time. And it's impossible to continue that forever.
And then you're holding it all in your head.
Yes, and it's all
and
there.
Someone and someone goes, how do you make the so-and-so? Yeah. And you have to go and show them every time. Yes.
So we had to learn to write recipes, and we had to learn to write recipes that actually work to produce the food we want to do. So it was a necessity of the thing. I never thought about writing a cookbook until we started writing down all the recipes of honey
and
coal.
I don't believe in recipes.
Really?
We very rarely use someone else's recipe. Really? Unless we're doing an event with them and we're cooking their food.
Yeah, because I think Mum writing her book just now, you've never worked in such a recipe way in your life. Because I said, oh, I've never tried to cook one of your recipes. And you said, because you wouldn't have ever, I never wrote anything down.
Not really. That's the hardest. So the writing bit, the text, the prose, all of that, fine. Mm. Just, you know, I can chat for England and I like to chat and that's just me chatting.
Well, you're a storyteller.
Yeah, and that bit of trying to, like, make, you know, consistently make it exactly the same way every single time. There's this brilliant restaurant that I love in Marrakesh called Al Fasiya.
Yeah,
and it's the one with all the women.
The women.
You've been there?
Yeah. Amazing.
What is it?
It's amazing.
Women cooks.
It's the food from Fez, which is in the north of Morocco. And it's run by these two sisters. Very unusual in Morocco. But I went into the kitchens there and they don't have anything written down. At all. And there's like 15 people, there's 15 women in this kitchen, and they just all know exactly how to make every single one of these dishes. It's not even in her mind, it's in her soul, you know what I mean? She could do it asleep, probably. Yeah, and they just don't write any of it down.
We went with our team to Israel. We went to cook with an Arab family in one of the villages near my parents. So they still live in the traditional way where it's a three-story house, so the grandparents live on the ground floor. Their first generation children live on the first floor and their children live on the top floor. And the grandmother downstairs cooks for everyone.
And as they die, they go down.
They go down, it's true. And if they haven't died yet, they'll build an extension and another, and so the next kids would live upstairs. Anyway, they were a lovely, lovely family. And the mother was cooking with us, the grandmother, actually, I would say. And she also didn't have any recipes. And everything was by feel. Everything was by touch. Everything was by saying. And she would say to us, yes, you can cut it like that. But it would be the wrong way to cut it. But you can do it that way. Yeah. And we're like, okay, so tell us how to do it. But everything's done with, like, a small paring knife. You know, nothing is, like, definitely no chef knives. No chopping boards. Everything by hand or in your hand.
Yeah.
And it was funny because you take a group of chefs and they're sitting there and they see a completely different way of producing food, thinking about food, tasting. And then she was making kibbeh with us. Have you ever had this? It's like a raw lamb with bulgur wheat. It's a very, very traditional dish. And every one of the chefs was quite dubious about eating this. Because,
raw lamb.
Yeah. Because first of all, we don't eat raw lamb here. It's not really something that's ever done. And when you're kind of in a village with a house that I don't even know if there was a fridge in the house, to be honest. And they were all like, oh, really, are we going to eat this? Or they were all looking at me while they she was making stop. It. And it's like pounding, you pound the lamb, you pound, you know, it's a very long process of kneading it and making it. And they were all like, ooh. And then she served us the first one. And I just saw this chef looking at me. And I was like, eat it, because you're not going to embarrass us now. And he took it, a bite, and he was like, oh my God. Oh, and then the guy started eating it, and they just couldn't stop.
We couldn't stop.
No, it was delicious. Wow. So delicious. Wow. But like everything that in your head and in health and hygiene rules and everything is wrong.
Yeah.
It was amazing. It was so delicious.
So when I started researching my book, I was looking at heritage Caribbean recipes, and there's so many, because it's oral tradition, there's so many things you just couldn't find. Like, you know, there are things like, there's a thing called sha-sha dumpling, which is like a cornmeal dumpling that is made on the barbecue, on the fire, but you make it in sea grape leaves, which are a bit like fig leaves, but because they're big and they're spread like that, and you put it in the sea grapes and you keep turning it, and then it goes crispy, and then you take it out of that, and then you finish it off on the thing. But it's such an old... It's so delicious. But it's such an old recipe. I couldn't find it anywhere. I had to go and find an old lady. But it was really interesting, and, you know, just, like, sort of thinking about that kind of oral history. The one thing is spelt, like, 15 different ways because it's not really ever been written down very, very often, you know what I mean? And I feel like now that I need to make sure that I get as many of these things down.
That's why your book's so special, as possible. To have it.
Is it the same with your cultural kind of...
In Israel, the diaspora is from everywhere. Mm. Like loads of Moroccan, Yemeni, Eastern Europeans, Egyptians.
Yeah. No, but I do think that we're kind of like the generation... with the grandmas still in one foot in another country. So my grandma was born in Egypt. My grandpa was born in Yemen. And your grandparents were still...
Were they from England?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's kind of like the step after. That's all the information that could be done. And actually, a friend of ours in Israel does that. She collects all of these recipes for a museum.
Right. Yeah. An archive of food and traditions and...
But kind of like this generation is gone dead.
Yeah.
And now we have this material, what we remember, and we can mess around with it and do some damage.
Yeah, because then once you understand that and you get and you know those recipes and you know that heritage like properly, then you can start going, oh, maybe I'll do this with the tamarind, or maybe I'll do this with it. I mean, obviously, aunties and grannies and I don't really like
they don't appreciate
to do that.
No. They don't appreciate
it. I put planted in fungi quite recently. Fungi is like our cornmeal dish, like a bit like polenta, but we make it a bit stiffer. And normally it has okra and onions running through. It's absolutely delicious. You have it with saltfish and stuff. Yeah. And I made a planted coconut one, and it's really, really good. But literally,
it did not go down well.
It's old people looking at me like, what have you done? Like, what is your problem? I'm
like, I'm just having fun.
Yeah. You're like, whatever. But I think that. So that generation holds on to those things like that.
Yeah.
Because they need to know who they are.
Yeah.
It's like it gives them their direct connection, their direct route back to all the things that are important to them and all the things that they are terrified of losing and have always been terrified of losing. In a way that our generations, I mean, I'm older than you guys, but our generations probably are less, we're a bit more blasé about it.
We don't need it so much. But this is why, like when we started... Honey & Co. and then we started thinking about this, like, for me, authenticity was so important. Like, it had to be like the aunties. But now I'm just like, fuck the aunties. It needs
Come
to
on,
be...
That's too strong.
Fuck the aunties. No, because I'm saying, you know, yes, it was really important for them because that was the identity.
Yes.
But for us, it's something else. It's about pleasure. It's about joy. It's about coming together. It's about reaching out from my aunties to yours.
To my aunties, yes.
This is what matters now.
Right.
It's not about
if it means like three fingers of oil instead of one, then I know what I'm going. Like, and actually, when people be like, Yeah, but this is not how we do it. You're exhausting me, man. I'm not interested anymore.
Also, what I think is interesting, so it's not how you do it. It's how I do it.
Yeah.
And every household is different anyway. So even if you had, like, the one thing, curry goat or whatever, every household's different because recipe, everybody's cooking a slightly different version of curry goat. And everybody had a nervous breakdown because I put chocolate in my curry goat.
Yeah, that's when the aunties came
really
from.
Good.
They come
really?
For you, though.
Really? In person. I had to talk to someone for 45 minutes.
Oh no!
But why I put chocolate? I said because it's good.
Yeah.
This is the this what? Is my final yeah. answer.
This is kind of a conversation that annoys me about all the like. There's this whole thing about like publishing a recipe and people saying to you, "Oh, but that's not it, what it is." Like
we have spoken about this before, and I'm always really interested in this, and I just think we can't stop talking about it, and it changes really, like the ideas of how excellence is measured in a kitchen in an industry. In our industry, in this country, there's Michelin, and then there's so-called casual dining, and then there's kind of fast food or slash street food or whatever. And, you know, there's, like, one of the best noodle places I know is just these two boys in a little truck down on the South Bank, and they make the best, send noodles. They make the best absolute noodles.
South Bank.
I just think that... Do you see the industry shifting at all away from those ideas of Michelin excellence and there being any other ways to look at it?
I think the financial model is screwed. Mm-hmm. Like the Michelin restaurants, they don't have the financial model. And, you know, with labor costs, it doesn't happen. You know, if you think there are a few restaurants who sort of make it work, but it's not long term, I don't think. And it's not actually it's not where the interesting stuff happens. And it's not where the delicious stuff happens. I think the delicious
the
stuff
delicious stuff is in a different category, kind of like, I think.
In the middle and on the sides. It doesn't happen at the top. Mm. The top where it goes to die. Or, the Michelin top.
And is the top resistant to that change?
I think it's an interesting thing. You know, it's actually an interesting conversation to have specifically with you. Because the show you host, Great British Menu, we watch avidly. Yeah. We have for many, many years. But even for us, we came from the place of, like, admiring all the less, like, kind of fine dining thing to, like, saying, oh, my God, they've got to, like, give space for more types of food. And we get quite angry when they're immediately, like, disqualifying a whole range of cooking that is kind of unfamiliar to them sometimes. Well, and that does happen a bit.
No, that's why I think it's really good that we moved on in terms of the judging panel.
Yes.
Because there's a much broader palette. You know, you've got Nisha who can, like, identify different types of cardamom at 200 paces. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And,
no, but also isn't scared of spice.
And is not scared of spice, but also knows spice and understands spice. And so does Ed, because he eats out everywhere in the world. And he's just Mr. Greedy. He loves it. And then Tom, who represents another kind of end of the industry. But I think that in a way, that's kind of that representation in that room. That's kind of how the representation or the thoughts about what means brilliance has to kind of shift.
Yeah.
Because it can't continue, I don't think, in the world to be just through one particular lens. And it's not about cancelling out a lens. French route and do all that stuff. I have every respect and admiration for them because that shit is hard.
But it's also okay at some stage
it's
to accept
the only thing.
That it's not the only thing. And again, when I used to work in Michelin star, this was a long time ago, but we would never taste the food. It was too expensive for us to taste. I never sat there.
Of course.
I never tasted a dish.
Of course.
I worked there for 2.5 years. I never ate a full dish.
Wow.
Of any of the things we had on the menu. So how are you supposed to do that? So, yeah, I was a commie to a demi. I was quite low. It was my first job in the industry. But how are you supposed to make sure the food you're serving is delicious? Because there's a difference between eating a spoon of soup and eating a whole bowl of soup and understanding where your flavor ends at the end of that. So, like, if a chef, all they're allowed to do is, like, taste a tiny bit of their sauce or eat the end of a mash or something, but never sit and eat the whole thing and think of the impact of eating mash that's, like, 90% butter... with a whole load of reduction sauce and a really rich piece of meat, and they've never eaten all of that together, then they don't know what they're serving. And I think it's a whole industry that's built on not understanding food.
Mm.
Plus, they're all 20 to 25-year-olds, because after that, you burn out in that kind of kitchen.
Yeah.
A mistake that I see quite a lot of young chefs making, as I see them coming through the Great British Menu Kitchen, is they're so obsessed with getting this star that they forget about being delicious.
Yeah.
It's like, it doesn't matter about the star. Just think about the food. Just think about.
I mean, look at St. John's. St. John's, for years, delicious food doesn't look
delicious specifically. It doesn't necessarily look simple. Delicious, delicious food with respect to ingredients, going for years, doing it well for years. This is kind of the... So there's like a big distance between...
It's like the historic difference between like food as spectacle and as display and as about, not about, you know, never was about taste. Historically, it was about kind of impressing people, whether it's your guests or whether it's, you know, you're the king chef and therefore I have the best chef and I'm the richest person. And so there's a way in which that sort of food is still in a kind of state of perpetual performance where the actual pleasure and taste and exchange is sort of forgotten.
Because, you know, to me, somebody coming to the table with that big giant pot and putting it in the middle and with that thunk when the pot hits table, I'm just like, oh my God, my toes are curling up, I'm ready to go, I'm like really, really happy. So there's different kinds of spectacle and there's different kinds of perception of what constitutes beauty
and what constitutes
something, you know, desirable and exciting and aspirational.
But when you do the pot on the table like that, that is about acknowledging all those people around the table and bringing them all into that, whereas the kind of cloche being lifted from the plate is about the display of the chef. It's not about the people at the table and the group. It's about, look at me. I'm the person that created this.
I want to ask you both one thing, actually, which is, what's the future like? Look like for you?
At the moment, it's full of change, which is going to be interesting, because the pandemic really changed like everything. We thought we were on the way to stepping away from the business, handing it over to our exec team and just kind of not really being involved. We thought we were going to focus on other things, and then the pandemic, and this was like 2019, and then we were going to try and like take a place in Greece for 6 months and see if we could like set up something there, and you know, and then the pandemic hit and everything just went like, and we ended up like 100% back in the business in terms of like everything. And saw the difference that it makes in a strange way. It's quite hard to explain.
When you're fully involved.
Yes.
Yeah, right. But for me, again, it's too early to say, but I think it's the making of us, to be honest. And I think that we're just starting now.
Yeah, in a way, it like, kind of refreshed
either
the whole,
it's
like...
the end of us?
Or it's just the beginning.
No, it may be the end but of for us me, as well. I think we have to say this may be the end as well.
Oh, my God.
We have,
like
a, no, we
jeopardy.
Have a really big project on the go, can we say?
I mean, we're hoping that it's not too far in the future, and it's like another location, but it kind of stemmed from everything that's happened, and it hopefully answers some needs that came up over the last few years, and if it works well... It would be amazing and will be the making of us. Or like we say, we, you know, sign the bankruptcy note.
What did we say? If your dreams aren't big enough, if your dreams don't scare you, they're not big enough.
Mm. So it's
they're shit scary. Every morning we're scared to leave the bed. Wake up crying.
That means you are exactly on track.
Honestly,
here's your dream being just big enough to scare the shit out of you.
Yeah. The bejesus. I mean, guys, I have to say, this was beautiful. And actually, you guys are very beautiful together.
So are you.
You guys.
Thank you so much.
So are you.
Back at you.
Thank you so much for coming. Honestly, it really is lovely of you to give us your time, because I know how busy you are. So I'm really happy to have you in our home too. Now you know where we live, so you can come back.
That's really dangerous for you. You are like, honestly, you're 3 months away from a restraining order against us. I'm not even joking.
I want to say...
be like,
get behind the sun. That was so nice. I mean, interesting having a third person there, but I really liked it. Itamar and Sarah brought us loads of honey and toast.
Smoked almonds.
Got it. This, no, you won't.
Because I really eat almonds.
Yeah, this is chocolate and hazelnut babka. Oh my God. Don't touch it. Get away.
Get away from the
move,
babka.
Move, child, move.
And then Polly bought us this beautiful book, Unfinished Business, The Fight for Women's Rights, edited by Polly Russell and Margareta Jolly from the British Library.
Somewhat comforting to know that people like Polly are at places like that at the British Library.
Yeah, and also doing more than lip service, doing actual real work.
Yeah, because there's some problematic history in our museums and libraries, okay? So to have the right people there feels exciting.
A lot of women in these positions, in these institutions, were genuinely changing things. And I feel like that was a table full of guests who are changing things. You've got Itamar and Sarit doing this incredible food, working in the way that they do. You've got Polly at the British Library, really at the vanguard of pushing things forward, pushing change. And I think that we do it too, Mickey. So I'm going to big ourselves up in this conversation. We are also two people who are pushing for change and making change happen. And it's the only way that this stuff is ever going to shift is if we push and push hard. And I feel like today and that lunch was a celebration of that.
Another triumph in the please tell us who you'd like to bring to lunch today. And people just seem to be bringing people they really love.
They really love, who they have really deep connections with. Mm. And this is what's always happened in our life, right? So now I'm like, oh, Polly.
Yeah, she's
I'm going to hang out with Polly as well.
Yeah, Polly.
Because Itamar and Sarit, like if I'm at an industry thing, I'm like, oh, great, Itamar and Sarit here, cool.
Yeah.
I've got people I can talk to. It's going to be great. And then now Polly, I just feel like is a new person in our horizon. I can't wait to see what they're about to do next. I'm really intrigued.
I was this close. This close. She really told me. She sort of looked at me with, and I sort of looked at her like, this is a safe space. And then she went, nah. You know, it's just a new project. I was like, yeah, she's not telling us shit. But we can't wait.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.